Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm here for Dr. Lee, who is in the courtroom today. there are two actual matters before the court, I believe. There's the preliminary injunction appeal, and then there is a motion for a preliminary injunction itself that was forwarded to this panel. I don't know if the court...
Yes, we have it.
Okay, good. These are very important issues, most respectfully, in the healthcare industry, very important for doctors and other healthcare providers. It's the first time, I believe, a court of appeals has been presented with the sanction that we're talking about here, the affiliation sanction. In Dr. Lee's case, it's a 10-year debarment, which most respectfully is a career killer for a doctor.
So what do you, I want to get clarity on what you're asking a federal court to do, because it matters because of these issues about whether this is a collateral challenge and whether we need to wait for an administrative process to play out. So what is it that you want here?
And that goes to the thrust of it. We never went to the district court, to Judge Carter, wanting him to rule on the merits of certain issues in this case. We thought there are two very prominent legal issues, and that's why we are here, and that's why we believe we are properly here.
Okay, so what are the two prominent legal issues?
That that Dr. Lee has been denied due process of the law because he has been debarred prior to any meaningful opportunity to be heard.
Okay, so the first is you want a pre-deprivation hearing?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, we think he was entitled to that under due process. And the second is that under any circumstances, even if there were some, what I'll use the word liability here for being affiliated as he was, there is no statutory authority for a 10-year debarment sanction. We can look at the statute all we want to. That's 1395 CC. Parens J, close parens, parens 5, close parens, and you'll see absolutely no authority in there for something as harsh as a 10-year a 10-year debarment.
All right, let me pause you on the second piece of this, the statutory authority piece. So if Dr. Lee goes through the administrative process, goes to the ALJ and the DAB, can he then, at the end of that process, go to federal court and make this statutory authority argument?
He would not lose the statutory argument. The problem is he has to suffer the consequences of the 10-year debarment the whole time he's going through the administrative appeal. In other words, the sanctions are not stayed for any reason during the administrative appeal process. So he has to litigate throughout that administrative appeal.
Okay, how long do you think that HHS has? What authority do they have in order to debar? Can they debar for a year?
I don't think they have any debarment authority.
Look at the statute. So your argument is that you cannot debar them at all?
Well.
What can they do?
Well, let's talk about the Secretary has the authority to debar doctors and other healthcare providers under an entirely separate system, under 42 U.S.C. Section 1320A-7. That's not the system we're talking about there. That's called an exclusion, and that's for bad doctors who have been convicted of crimes, bad providers who have been convicted of crimes, and other separate kinds of deals than this. This is an affiliation. This is because you've been affiliated with someone who is alleged to have abused their billing privileges. There is no authority for that in 1395 CC parens J, close parens. That, what it says is, if in fact there is what I'll call a bad affiliation, if there's a bad affiliation, all the secretary is empowered under 1395, and I'm not going to keep saying the statute, but all he's empowered to do under that is deny enrollment. There is absolutely no language and no support that says, well, not only can you deny enrollment, you can also keep them out for 10 years. That's a debarment. And the secretary,
I'm sorry. What's the difference between denying enrollment? What does that What does that mean to you?
Well, denying enrollment means that they could stop temporarily authorizing the payment for services, but you don't automatically get debarred for that. You get an application, you get an opportunity, you should have an opportunity to cure the problem. And this gets tricky, but under 1395, at the first part of the statute where they're talking about termination of providers, Dr. Lee is not a provider, he's a doctor, he's a supplier. But under the first part of 1395 CC, there is a provision in there where the secretary can terminate someone's enrollment. But that's not where they are on this one. This one is on the affiliation sanction, and that they don't use the same language in there, Your Honors. And that termination lasts as long as there are not adequate assurances given to the secretary by the provider that the problem has been fixed. I mean, again, the debarment is the problem here because it says to the healthcare community, and it's published. It's published, widely published. And it says to the healthcare community, this guy did something so bad that we're going to debar this person for 10 years. Now, imagine if lawyers had something like this, and there's no due process type hearing before any of this goes into effect.
That's your first point. So I mean, that's the due process problem. It's the Matthews versus Eldridge problem, which is very different from the ultravirus.
The ultravirus is there is nothing in 1395 CC parens J close parens that authorizes a debarment. When Congress wants the secretary to have the power to debar, Congress has plainly said, if you look in 1320A7, these are the time periods you can debar this person for a crime, but that's a very separate statute. It doesn't authorize the secretary to all of a sudden decide, well, I like that idea of debarring. It may make headlines.
Okay. I think to go back to Judge Bress's question, I think the question is, why couldn't all of this be addressed at the end of HHS proceedings appeal?
Because of the irreparable harm that is being suffered. He doesn't have a job. He can't be employed. He's been, and this is, there's this ongoing harm. Now, the government will say, oh, no, he'll find a place somewhere working with private patients, but it doesn't work because not only does he...
How long does this administrative process take to run its course?
I'll represent that I've done these, not in this particular area, but he's in it right now. And, you know, he was debarred effective June 14, 2025. He continues to be debarred, and we have already gone to the administrative law judge. Their hands are tied, Your Honors. They cannot deal by regulation. They cannot deal with the period of debarment. So they can't even deal with that. And they have to give all kinds of deference to the decision of the.
But how long does the process take? Why can't you ask?
It takes 2 years.
We are now,
he was debarred June 2025. Here we are, August 2026. He's lost at each step, except he's now in the final step, the appellate step, and they have 5 months from now to issue a final decision.
But if you were to prevail on your first argument,
yes,
there would not be anything until the conclude. There would not be anything final to debar him until HHS had completed its review, right? If you win on your first argument.
And the first argument being the due process.
The Matthews versus Eldridge, the pre-deprivation hearing.
Yes, and that's all we wanted.
But what I'm saying is that irrespective of how long it would take to go through an administrative hearing, he's not going to be debarred until all of those hearings are completed and he's ready to appeal to us. And then the question is, so what's the problem?
No, he's been debarred.
I understand that he has been debarred.
If we win, if this court were to reverse the district court and say he should not be, all we wanted was Judge Carter to stop the debarment, stop the sanction from going into effect until he gets through the administrative hearing. We'd be glad to go through
that's
the
That's your first point. Maybe we ought to turn to that. So that's your Matthews versus Eldridge argument that he's entitled to a pre-debarment hearing.
Yeah, and that doesn't happen in every situation. This court, in a Ninth Circuit case called Guzman, I know the case because we handled it, said if it's a temporary suspension and it's not published to the world or to the medical community, Dr. Guzman was not entitled to a pre-hearing. But that was a temporary suspension. This is a debarment, and this is published to the world, to the healthcare world. I mean, hospitals have already said, we heard from the National Practitioner Data Bank, you've been debarred, you're gone. So that's the problem with this, because it's a liberty interest that's affected here, and this court knows that. It's a liberty interest. It's the right to have your reputation, and a reputation for honesty and integrity, and for a doctor, that reputation is critical. He's blackballed is what the problem we're having here. So that's where we are. I hope I've made that clear. In other words, what he loses here by having this go into effect is that the world looks at him as someone who has been debarred by the Medicare program, and he is not going to be someone we will associate with. As a matter of fact, using this affiliation sanction, no hospital or anyone who hires him they'll be affiliated with him. That's what the government's
doing. I'm listening to this. I'm trying to figure out how much of your argument is with the law of affiliation, which, you know, as I understand it, says if you were the medical director of this other hospice that had an issue, we're going to charge you with, you know, knowledge and responsibility of it. I'm paraphrasing, but how much of your argument is really just an objection to that arrangement?
Well, we can't object to it through the administrative appeal process, because they say if you're a medical director, you are by law affiliated with. We will lose that issue. We're losing it all the time, and not only in this case, in every case. They say you've been affiliated with a bad actor and you're out. But we're not challenging that. We're challenging the due process. Why does he have to suffer so much during this process, which we are quite willing to go through as long as he's not debarred? And we are challenging the fact that at the end of it, there should never be a right to the debarment of 10 years, because Congress didn't give the secretary that right. As your honors know, under the Administrative Procedure Act, we've quoted, and under case law, Congress has to be specific about that. I was ready to go into a lot of jurisdiction things. I know I'm getting close, based in large part upon the Axon Enterprises case. And I must say, on Friday, I tuned in Judge Bress and listened to that argument in the AFGE case there. And I only say that because I think Axon Enterprises controls the proper analysis of jurisdiction in this case. It was decided after the sensory case, by which is what the government and what Judge Carter relied on. That was a 2020 case, and of course Axon Enterprises was a 2023. I could go through all that. I'm trying to save a little bit of time here.
Okay, we'll put 3 minutes on the clock when you come back.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Assistant United States Attorney Alexander Farrell on behalf of Appellee Secretary Kennedy. This court should affirm the district court's order, the order of dismissal for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. The district court found that Dr. Lee did not complete the appropriate and required administrative procedures prior to filing suit. When Dr. Lee first filed his lawsuit in February 2026, he was still in the administrative exhaustion process. When the dismissal order was entered, he was still there.
But the argument is that you have adjudged him guilty before you gave him a hearing, and you have publicized it. You put it on the website. It has collateral consequences to him in his medical practice, and you did so without a hearing. His administrative procedures are such that he may proceed through additional administrative procedures and then will be given a hearing before an ALJ. So that's the problem.
Thank you, Your Honor. So Dr. Lee, when he first received notice of it, the Medicare Act has provided a multi-level set of review, and especially with the ALJ proceedings, there are a lot of processes there to build an administrative record that allows Dr. Lee to hear, the charges, the assertions that are brought against him, as well as see the evidence.
Well, I read the letter from Navidian, which lays out things out very, very carefully. It's quite limited what he can do. Where he's really going to get an opportunity is once it's gone through Navidian and gone through the reconsideration process, and then he can request a hearing before an administrative law judge. The problem is, in the meantime, you have posted on your website that he has been debarred, and that has real-world consequences for him. Isn't he entitled to a hearing before you make that judgment?
Well, Your Honor, I think the website does have some disclaimer information that it only covers certain types of Part A, certain parts of Medicare, but it also states that it's an ongoing process, and so the list is updated as it goes on.
And a hospital that was thinking about hiring Dr. Lee ought to be assuaged by all of that and think that we should go ahead with this when you've put his name on a list.
Well, Your Honor, what a private hospital is willing to do in terms of hiring decisions, I certainly understand the concern that Dr. Lee, may have to have this on his list, but there are other options. There are opportunities where, Dr. Lee is able to work. He's in one of his declarations, he stated, there has been a reduction.
Counsel, not being able to work in Medicare is a death knell in the medical field. Yes, there might be things that he can do. Maybe he can go to scout camp and be the scout camp doctor for 2 weeks during the summer. But he's not going to go to any Medicare affiliated institution, and that is just about everybody.
Well, Your Honor, I would also say that Dr. Lee did include a declaration saying he was able to see private patients, and also.
If the fight is over, is he harmed? I think you're going to lose that one. The question is, how is all this supposed to be routed with this other administrative process that has been set up by law? And there, I think I'm wondering whether we need to be distinguishing between the two claims that he's bringing, the due process claim on the one hand and the ultra vires claim on the other. I have real concerns with the ultra vires claim being just a kind of, end run, if you will, around the administrative process and not being collateral in the way the Supreme Court's discussed. But with respect to the due process point, I think cases have said, no, that is collateral because you're not asking for any particular result out of this. You're just asking for a different set of procedures. And that has not been adjudicated. That's a Matthews v. Eldridge. That's a balancing argument. You've got your arguments, right? He has his arguments. Those arguments are being made to us. The district court didn't consider any of this, though.
Yes, I agree with your comments, Your Honor. I think... there still is a whether Dr. Lee is eligible for a pre-deprivation hearing prior to his.
Why is that not collateral? Isn't that collateral? I mean, we're not that is Matthews v. Eldridge itself, actually.
I don't think that's collateral because, for example, if he would have won if in the first step with the request for reconsideration, if the hearing officer reversed the initial CMS decision, that would have still been within a 30-day period to appeal.
Sure, but he hadn't been given a hearing. He's been hamstrung as to the evidence that he can produce in that kind of a proceeding. It's not a full-blown hearing. The full-blown hearing is reserved for the ALJ. That's made quite clear in the letter.
Yes, but Your Honor, I still think that that Dr. Lee is able to provide some level of evidence in that initial.
Counselor, this might be entirely different if Navidian said, "We're going to do this. Here's how you appeal this, and we aren't going to do any listing until we're through this procedure, and then you can go to an ALJ." Might be completely different. Process. Even if the process was informal, it was not the full-blown, fulsome process that we get before an ALJ. If you hadn't put his name on the list, we might be in a very, very different procedural posture. You put his name on the list. You announced to the world what the result was. And then you decided to hold a limited proceeding, and then he can get a full proceeding before an ALJ. Can the government explain why they think that's fair?
Your Honor, I still think, you know, from the disclosures that are on the website, I think there is enough there for the public, for the general public to understand that it's a limited placement on that preclusion list, but not necessarily that he is unable to work anywhere, or that there's commentary about his character and fitness as a doctor.
What are the defenses to this affiliation theory? So, is it a permissible defense to say, "I was the medical director of this hospice, but I actually didn't know about some of these billing practices"? Is that a viable defense, or does it not matter?
Your Honor, I think there are multiple factors under the regulation that the ALJ can consider. I think looking at a fact-specific standpoint of his interactions with those patients, his interactions in terms of signing off on the language about whether the patient is terminally ill. Whether he brings in witnesses at the hospice entity,
is that even an argument someone can make? I mean, if your medical director, as I read the CMS letter, is basically saying, you know, you were medical director, this happened on your watch, you're responsible for the medical decisions at the hospice, therefore, we are charging you with those, being responsible for those, without going into, "We know you saw patient X, we see your signature on this document," any of that stuff. And so my question, I guess, is when this goes into an administrative process, can he come in and make some of these arguments, or does it just not matter?
Yes, Your Honor. And during the ALJ hearing, the court has the ALJ has the ability to hear testimony, subpoena witnesses, have an oral hearing, and produce a volume of record that's not just limited to what the hearing officer made in their initial determination. So it's a very expansive process that I think will ultimately help the district court when they get the final agency action have a full comprehensive record of all the evidence that was considered. And Dr. Lee may be able to prevail during this administrative process. If he's able to convince the ALJ to reverse the initial determination, then his due process concerns should be resolved because he'll be reinstated back into the program.
Right, but he would say, "Well, yeah, but three years have gone by in which I can't practice medicine, so that wasn't, you know, it's great that I won in the end, but this has been a terrible 3 years in the meantime." And so some of the questions I was asking really go more to whether the interests on both sides, which hasn't been decided by the district court because of the jurisdictional holding. And I see the interests on both sides. I understand his interests, and presumably the government has interests in saying, "Look, we are entitled to this kind of presumption to stop somebody to announce that this person is associated with this business that has been known to submit fraudulent billing." That's an interesting question as to who should win that Matthews v. Eldridge balancing test. But I guess the question I have hearing this, if you're conceding or not seriously pushing back on the idea that it's collateral, whether this should just go back to the district court for the district court to consider that.
Well, so I do think it is. Our position still remains that it is not collateral. And so.
So on what basis can you make that argument?
As to the.
As to the hearing, as to the pre-deprivation
the
hearing.
The pre-deprivation?
Yeah.
I think simply be, I think because of the, still from the multi-level review, if I understand the facts of this case are a bit, I guess the history of this case have gone beyond the district court's opinion in terms of he's gone on to additional levels of review. But had he been, you know, at that initial stage where he was able to reverse the initial request for reconsideration, I think it would still be collateral because if he had filed, for example, when he was in district court in February, the first level of review was still there, and the second level of review had not had been initiated but not been fully briefed out. And so I think I think this actually goes towards the first.
Counsel, Judge Gould, I sort of interject to interrupt, but I've been asked, Judge, just to give you a few extra minutes at the end of argument if you don't have time. But what I want to know is that more what our power as a Court of Appeals is. For example, I share the concerns that Judge Bybee and Judge Bress have both expressed, this, which is the way I would put it. You know, what happens in the interval before this gets resolved in the administrative process? Now, do we have the power? Would we have the power to issue an order to the district court that said we're pausing our review of this decision of Levy Kennedy that was made, and said we'd like you to hold a due process deprivation hearing before we proceed on that?
Thank you, Judge Gould. I think the relief that this court could provide is a remand back to the district court to first further address the subject matter jurisdiction issue on collaterality as to the pre-deprivation hearing. But I think going as far as entering a preliminary, you know, directing the district court to enter a preliminary injunction to either limit the bar, the re-enrollment period, or to seek the furthest extent of the relief that's sought from the complaint, I think would be further relief than necessary if the court was going to remand back to the district court.
Thank you.
Judge, do you mind repeating your last question?
No, I think Judge Gould's question actually got to what I was kind of going towards already.
Okay. With this, the government's position is still that the district court's this court should affirm the district court's decision in finding a lack of subject matter jurisdiction due to not administratively exhausting the claims. So thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'll be very brief. As to Judge Gould's inquiry, which I guess Judge Bress was also getting at, and I know the court needs to decide this, I do think this is a case where this court may and should, especially given the fact that Judge Carter kind of punted on the issues. He said these are complicated issues that I'll let the Ninth Circuit decide. With that matter, I think this court has the power to stay under the Administrative Procedure Act or to enjoin the sanctions from being from continuing to be imposed pending the outcome of further proceedings, which includes the administrative law judge and other parts of the administrative appeal decision. So I think the court may do that and most respectfully should do that. Judge Bress, again, I get the collateral issue regarding ultra-virus. I believe one of the TPS cases before the Ninth Circuit cited in our brief has characterized the ultra-virus as a constitutional issue, which also, it may be one of the AFGE cases or one of the TPS cases, which also is ultra-virus. But clearly, everybody has said due process is collateral. I may have misspoken there, but I meant that the ultra-virus should also be considered to be collateral. I will just bring the court up to date on this because there has been an administrative law judge hearing. And because this is continuing harm we're talking about, I think the administrative law judge ruled against Dr. Lee on every issue. The fact that he had nothing to do with the
bill. Is that ruling in the record? We don't have that.
I think it is in the, I'm almost positive it's in the administrative law judge's opinion is not in the record, I don't believe.
Because is that recent?
That was a couple of months ago. It might be, and I don't believe it is, because the government has been giving the court an update, but all of a sudden stopped the updates when we got here. And I will just represent, though, that the administrative law judge ruled against Dr. Lee on every point, did not give him the opportunity to cross-examine witnesses, said that everything was undisputed, and you lose, Dr. Lee, and I can't do a thing about your...
But was there witnesses and evidence at the hearing?
There was no hearing. She granted, they do this in every case. They say, well, because CMS says, well, really, there's no facts in dispute here, and we're not going to call any witnesses. And then the other side, us, we say, well, wait, there are facts in dispute here. And the administrative law judges, and there are two opinions in the record on this, say, well, we're just going to render summary judgment.
So it's effectively summary judgment. You now have an appeal right.
We're there now and for the Departmental Appeals Board. They are bound by the same rules. Counsel for the government says
okay.
This is
a what is it that this court could do given given that hearing has been held and you're now got an appeal that will be resolved probably fairly soon?
Five months. They have 5 months and they never get it done in 5 months. That's what I was saying. They have six months
from what date?
Well, they had 6 months from the date of the ALJ's decision, and it's been a month since the ALJ's.
Okay.
So there's 5 months left, which in the meantime, it may not seem like much, but this court, I can tell, understands the harm caused to the doctor every day that goes by.
Let's suppose that we thought that there had been a constitutional violation here on the first point, on the question of the pre-hearing deprivation. We sent this back to Judge Carter, and Judge Carter runs the algorithm for Matthews versus Eldridge and comes back and says, yeah, I agree with you. No pre-deprivation. You were entitled to a hearing before he was deprived of his reputation. Okay, what happens now? What would happen then?
Well, would be our turn to tell people on behalf of Dr.
Right, but then you'd be entitled to a hearing.
Before,
that hearing's already been held.
The hearing's been held, and it's preordained how you're going to handle it because their hands are so tied.
Because
where we're going to get ultimate. What we are confident ultimately will prevail will be before the district court when the district court's hands aren't tied by jurisdiction.
And it goes to the district court, not to the court of appeals?
It's not like the AFGE where the appeal is always to the court of appeals.
Okay, so the relief that could be given to your client is that if we were to send this back to Judge Carter and he were to decide this fairly expeditiously,
yes,
your client's name could be removed off the website.
Yes, and our client would attempt then to say, you know, we haven't really had our day in court, as the courts have said, and that will, they are no longer revoked. You'd have to lift the revocation, and all the sanctions would have to be lifted.
But then you're entitled to a hearing, and the ALJ can decide this on effectively summary judgment.
We will lose before the ALJ, as we already have.
The ALJ can say, we've been there and we've done that.
And we'll lose before the appellate panel, because everyone does.
But at least in the interim, he would be off the website.
Then we'll get to a district court. And I think a judge, when they see what is happening here, we are confident a judge will say, well, this goes too far. And in any event, you can't debar him for this for 10 years because there is no statute.
And you could raise the 10-year debarment at that point.
I'm sorry?
You could raise the 10-year question, the ultra vires question. Before the district court
These were stayed, we would have no problem, but it would be in the district court because the administrative law judges in the appellate panel of the agency are not authorized to do anything with the 10-year. Because,
counsel.
Yes, Judge.
Judge Gould again. Let me return to a point you earlier covered. You said if we were concerned that there was a pre-deprivation due process violation, we could send it back to the district court. My concern is and ask for more consideration, but maybe with some guidelines. Still, my concern is that could entail a great deal of delay, because we don't know how quickly the district court would be able to act or would act. So what I'm wondering is there any relief that our panel could give in the interim?
Well, I think the relief would have to be in the interim, Your Honor, I think the relief would have to be the sanctions are lifted on Dr. Lee until there is a final decision, which includes, I think, a final decision by the United States District Court and this court system. Because I think he will, if he goes back again, as the Judge Bybee said, it'll be rubber stamped again. So, but I'm for to get it lifted for now, pending the outcome of the appeal process, would be something. Then I think there wouldn't be a jurisdiction issue, and we could go to Judge Carter or whoever and say, hey, enjoin this until you rule on the merits, because we think these merits have not been decided properly.
Can I ask you on the merits? So I understand you have this sort of statutory argument that, you know, your client cannot be taken off the enrollment. He can't be disbarred for 10 years. I get those. Do you have other arguments specific to the facts? And did you raise those before the ALJ to the effect of it wasn't me or somebody else did this and I didn't know, or whatever arguments these might look like?
We raised all of that. We said we got declarations. Dr. Lee testified in his declaration. He had nothing to do with billing. He was a part-time medical director.
Are those permissible defenses before the agency?
Not according to the ALJ, because CMS takes a position. If you're the medical director, you're responsible for everything. That's where I get kind of the vicarious liability concept. I agree. I think there is something wrong with that affiliation statute, but that's not what we would be able to fight at this stage. The other thing we pointed out was, even before the hospice got kicked out or got revoked, the hospice got revoked, even before that decision was made, Dr. Lee quit because he had been at the hospice for 4 years. Then a new owner came in. He helped the new owner get through a survey, and then he tendered his retirement. And they said, well, that's not That's not our problem. You were affiliated with them during a period there were bad bills submitted, and you're out.
Before I end here, one quick question. On how many of these, how common is this to have an association-based, affiliation-based disenrollment or debarment? You seem to work in this area. Do you know?
We do. As a matter of fact, we have 4 cases pending, as Mr. Farrell will say, because he's handling them, 4 cases pending in the district courts in the Central District waiting for the outcome of this. And we have about 8 clients right now who are standing in line.
Okay.
A lot of people are dependent on what this court says.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. We appreciate the argument from both sides. This case is submitted, and that concludes our calendar for this morning.
All rise.